All right. Gonna be honest about something from last week. Doesn't happen a lot when I'm preaching, but I inspired me. I claimed, not really believing, that I was gonna do a 10-minute sermon, and doggone it, I did a 9-minute, 47-second sermon last week. But if my math is correct, that means I owe you about 48 to 52 minutes tonight. So, no, I'm just kidding. I do realize there's a preacher joke that's very true, like a joke maybe among preachers. Maybe you've heard it. I just always hear preachers talk about it among each other. And the joke is that, hey, if you need a 45-minute to an hour sermon, just give me a couple hours and I can do that. But if you need a good 20-minute sermon, I'm going to need a week or two to get that ready. And one of the downfalls of being a bivocational pastor, which means I have another job during the week, is that I don't get quite the time I used to. I mean, I used to spend like literally hours a day preparing for Sunday, and I could really kind of hone it down. And what tends to happen is you guys tend to get that little longer one. But I'm trying to challenge myself to get it all in a shorter amount of time, without just it's talking very, very quickly. And so I have less notes than I normally do tonight. I'm going to make a real effort. Now, there's no telling whether or not it'll happen, but I want you to know that I'm conscious of it and I'm working on it. If you were really big into short sermons, you probably wouldn't be here. So tonight I'm going to start actually with something this has never been a part of the beginning of a sermon, something that I read in a business book. I'm not big on business books. I haven't read a whole lot of them. In fact, most of the business books I read were in former church jobs, where every book they assigned us was like a business strategy book, which always bothered me at a church. I was like, is this really what we should always be sitting around and talking about? But it was a little while ago, I was in an airport and had some time to kill, so I walked by the bookstore with the books that are way more expensive than I'll ever pay, because that's an airport. And a book kind of caught my eye. It had a cool cover and all that, and it was called Essentialism. And it caught my eye, and then I opened it up, and I had to kill a little bit of time, so I flipped through the first couple pages, and then there's this diagram on one of the pages. I prefer books with pictures. So there's a diagram, and the diagram caught my eye, and then I'd read just a couple paragraphs, and it was one of those things where I should feel badly about the fact that one little diagram basically summed up my entire life. Because I feel like I should be more complicated than that. But here's what it was. It's a little hand-drawn kind of thing. I know it's hard to see. And I brought a laser pointer. What? So don't fall asleep tonight, is all I'm saying. So basically the point of it, the point of this little diagram that he had in the beginning, and again, this wraps up in some way my entire life, but definitely my work life. And the way he basically talks about it is that most of us do work like this. And that word right there is hard to see because it's a small font, and it's energy. And that's how we spend our energy. In other words, when he says most of us in our workplace or even in our life are taking our energy and we are doing a million different things a little bit, right? There was not a thing called ADHD when I was a kid. That was not a diagnosis, right? And I'm not making light of folks who struggle with that. I think I probably would have been diagnosed. There's a good chance. I mean, every one of my report cards was not working up to ability, not paying attention. I was kind of always off, And when I would write papers, I would leave off the second half of sentences a lot of times because I would already be on to the next sentence in my mind. So I would just start the next sentence. And then it wasn't until I got a bad grade on it that I'd go back and look at it and be like, what's going on? And realize that it made no sense because I was, thinking ahead of my writing. That's carried on through my life, and work life definitely ends up like that. And kind of the point of what he says is that in this book, and it's a couple hundred pages to make this basic point. Still interesting. If you want to read it, I recommend it. But the idea is to try and not be this. I'm not even close when I first start. I should not be in the military. Is that you want to move away from this because really you never get anywhere if you're doing that. And the idea is to learn to say no to things. The idea is to learn to get rid of the things that really you don't really want to be working on, you don't want to invest yourself in, and take your energy and instead put it in something where you're going to, cover some distance. You're going to make some progress on something as opposed to doing nothing much with a lot of things, right? So that's pretty much my life, especially my work life. And what I basically have here is my work life as it is and how it normally acts and the me I wish I was, right? Do y'all have a lot of that? There's a wide gap between the you and the you you put on Facebook or whatever, that the illusion of you that you would like to be one day. And I find that I am trying to figure out how to implement this in my life. As it turns out, just finishing that book didn't solve it for me, although I am keenly aware of how bad I am now. But I am trying to work on this, and I'm finding myself in life, not just kind of in work and the energy I have during the to spend during the 40 hours I'm at work or whatever, is that in general, I'm becoming myself, I find that I'm very far from, yet very drawn to, this kind of thing, this becoming more an essentialist, like what really matters, what am I really putting my time and energy into, what am I pouring my heart into, and instead of just kind of doing everything a little bit, trying to make some progress on something, right? And as I was preparing for this week, this is Transfiguration Sunday, I was this image came back to my mind because I feel like this is what happens in the text that we have for Transfiguration Sunday. I'm reminded of this principle. Transfiguration Sunday, to kind of catch you guys up, they do it every year. It's the week before Ash Wednesday and the week before Lent begins. And it's one of those tricky weeks as a preacher if you're doing the lectionary passages, because every year it's the same passage. And if you're preaching on the same passage once a year, eventually you start to feel like you're running out of things to say about it, right? And so the pastor's group that I sit down and talk with, everyone's like, oh boy, Transfiguration Sunday, what am I going to do this Sunday? I'd feel like I just preached this verse. And it's always interesting on these Sundays that have a very particular thing to talk about, what other, New Testament passage, Psalm and all that, that gets matched with it in the lectionary text. But the essential story of the Transfiguration, for those of you that don't know, I'll give you the Mike Dixon Revised Version, is essentially that Jesus takes a couple of his closest disciples. He takes Peter, James, and John, and they go up on this mountain, and he gives them access to what is a very kind of mystical mountaintop experience, right? And so he's with them, and then in front of their eyes, this kind of fantastic dreamlike thing happens where Jesus literally begins to glow white, right? Begins to come very kind of angelic and begins to glow white. And then it's kind of this glowing white, and then suddenly among them, it's not just Jesus and a couple of disciples, Peter, James, and John. After Christ begins to glow bright white, then suddenly Elijah and Moses show up. Right, the long since dead forefathers in the faith. Some will talk about one represents the law and one represents the prophets, so kind of covering the scope of Jewish history up to that point. And suddenly Elijah and Moses are there and they're talking with Jesus and we're not privy to what's being said. But Jesus is suddenly in the company of the heroes of the faith in front of them, right? In this kind of mystical, weird, dreamlike thing. So the disciples are having this moment, right? This amazing thing is going on in front of them. And then, as always, Peter steps up and does something, because Peter can never shut up or sit still. That's just not what he does. Like, I'm going to walk on the water. I'm going to do this. I'm going to cut off his ear. Like, that's just Peter. And that didn't all happen on the Mount of Transfiguration. Those are other stories. But Peter can't sit still. He can't sit in his hands. And so he says, we got to do something. This is amazing that we're here right now. Let's build a shrine, basically. Let's build a shrine, one for Jesus and one for Moses and one for you. And let's just build these three shrines. And he just, let's do something. Let's build something. I gotta do something, right? I can't just exist in this moment. God forbid that I actually just exist in this moment, right? I gotta take a selfie. I gotta do something to memorialize this moment instead of just enjoying it, right? Or taking it in. And at that point, then a cloud kind of envelops them all, and the voice of God comes, right? Which is always a good way to shut up someone who's doesn't know what to do with themselves. And God begins to speak about Jesus, and he says, quote, "This is my son whom I dearly love. Listen to him." This is my son whom I dearly love. Words very similar to the baptism, right, that we know. When the dove comes down, this is my son whom I dearly love, but he says, listen to him. And then suddenly the cloud goes away. No more forefathers from the faith. It's just Jesus and the disciples. After God has just said, this is my son whom I love, listen to him. And then Jesus gives the first command after they've just explicitly been told by God to listen to him. And it's a very mean thing to do because Jesus looks at them all and says, hey, don't tell anyone. Yeah, why would I want to talk to anyone about this? It's no big deal. It was just Jesus glowing and the four, you know, I got to see people I should never get to see. And God spoke directly to me in a cloud. Yeah, I definitely don't want to share this with anyone. Jesus, thanks. Appreciate that, right? And that's the end of the story. And you have this crazy story, this mystical thing that happens on the mountaintop. But it's important enough in the Christian tradition that we set aside a week every year to consider the idea. And it always comes before Lent. And again, I'm always interested on what other passages they pair with this, right? Because you end up preaching the same story over and over again, and then you want to kind of find some new life. And we've been taking the epistle tracts. We've been in the books of Corinthians, the letters of Paul. And what they pair with it this time is some verses out of 2 Corinthians chapter 4. And to catch up a little bit on where this verse is coming in, this is, of course, in what we would call Paul's second letter to the church of Corinth, although many people think there's probably a bunch of letters crammed together. So it may not technically be his second. But what has happened is Paul, you know, founded this church and he's written letters and he loves this church. And then some other people have come in behind Paul with a little bit different message. And they've claimed a superiority to Paul's message. And they're starting to kind of convert people away from what Paul has taught. And so he's now writing a letter kind of defending what he is taught and trying to convince people not to listen to these new folks that he ends up calling quote-unquote super apostles. And I'm not sure, he's either using the name that they've given themselves, which says something a little about them, and they're like, hey, we're super apostles. You know, that's all you need to know about them. And this is what I'd like to think, Paul's just being a jerk and he's being kind of sarcastic. He's like, oh, you want to listen to the super apostles? You know, like, that's how I read it. I always read it as super apostles. He may not have actually done that. But these apostles, you know, and we're always kind of, again, reading someone else's mail. So we look at what arguments Paul is making and we kind of assume that he's arguing against whatever. So you can try to piece together what these super apostles came in and said. And it appears that they, again, have claimed to know more than Paul, that they have claimed authority over Paul. It seems like they've probably emphasized kind of the miraculous and flashy, and maybe they've even gotten to do some things that really wowed other people. They're claiming to have more power, better credentials than Paul, more direct access to the truth, and maybe even kind of communicating a more kind of supernatural, ethereal kind of faith, the kind of faith that kind of floats above the ground and doesn't really suffer or struggle or doesn't, you know, those kind of things. Because it seems like, based on what Paul says in this letter, it seems like he's arguing against that kind of idea. And in fact, they probably even have used the phrase veiled in regards to Paul's teachings. That, like, he doesn't really see things well, right? It's kind of veiled. And so where we enter into, and the passage that's paired with the transfiguration story in the lectionary, in 2 Corinthians 4, 3 through 6, you see him immediately talking about the idea of whether or not the gospel that he preached is veiled. And it says this, and even if our gospel is veiled, it is veiled to those who are on the road to destruction, period. I mean, Paul's got to be sarcastic. I love this, right? He's like, oh, if it's veiled, it's probably veiled, you know, to those who are going to hell. So, I mean, so it may be veiled to them. Yeah, that may be, you know. It's veiled to those who are on the road to destruction. The God of this age has blinded the minds of those who don't have faith so they couldn't see the light. He's not really mincing words on those he's disagreeing with here. So they couldn't see the light of the gospel that reveals Christ's glory. Christ is the image of God. The icon of God is what in Greek. We don't preach about ourselves. Like the super apostles. We don't preach about ourselves. Instead, we preach about Jesus Christ as Lord, and we describe ourselves as your slaves for Jesus' sake. God said the light should shine out of the darkness, and He is the same one who shone in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of God's glory in the face of Jesus Christ. He is the same one who shone in our hearts to give us the light of the knowledge of God's glory in the face of Jesus Christ. So in response to the accusations of Paul's message being veiled, inglorious, unimpressive. First, he rips into the super apostles, saying they're blinded by the God of this world. Then he brings everything down to a very sharp focus. They can't see the light of the gospel that reveals Christ's glory. Christ is the icon, the image of God. We don't preach ourselves, instead we preach about Jesus Christ. The light of the knowledge of God's glory in the face of Jesus Christ. Paul claims here that his message is the opposite of veiled. It's very much focused. It's very clear. It's an unrelenting, clear focus on what is most essential. It's just about Jesus. It's just Jesus. Only on Jesus, who is the light, who is the image, the icon of God, who is the glory of God. You can't get less veiled than distilling it all down to this one particular person who lived in one particular place for about 33 or so particular years in the grand scope of history, in a specific place around specific people for a specific amount of time. This is as focused and essential as you can get. And Paul says it really is this simple. That's not an easy message, because of course Jesus is not easy. Right, the kind of ethereal feet floating off the ground, don't really have to struggle, don't really have to, I mean, that's a lot easier. Jesus died on a cross, right? I mean, this is not an easy message. Christ was simple and poor and suffered, all while being the fullness of God's glory. It isn't neat, it isn't easy, it isn't clean, because it's love. And of course, love is never easy and clean, especially not the kind of love that dies on a cross. But Paul brings it all back in just a couple sentences here and focuses it. It says it is always only about Jesus. They may talk well, they may show big signs, they may be super apostles. And when I first read this text, it didn't feel like it fit in Transfiguration. And then as I kind of read these next to each other, the Transfiguration story and this text, I began to really love it as a companion to the mountaintop experience story. Because they both end in the exact same place. Right on that mountaintop, those disciples, their heads are spinning, their hearts are spinning, right? They experience virtually everything in one fantastic experience. They are overwhelmed. They don't know what to do. They can't sit still. Just build something. Do something. They encounter their own religious history that has been passed down for thousands of years. They are encountering their own theological understandings working themselves out. They're bearing witness to the person that they've been walking and doing life with transformed in front of them. There's supernatural experiences that are happening. It's a life-changing event. Every part of them is being engaged at once. It's overwhelming. Their history, their experiences, their belief structures all collide at once in one flash of blinding light. I don't know about you, but that would set me off in 500 directions at the same time. And then the cloud comes, and God's voice snaps them back, and all they get to hear, "This is my son, whom I love. Just listen to him." With all these things flashing around them at once, with all that is going on, there is stillness. And at the end of that stillness, there is only one thing. Jesus. All that really matters in the end, God says, "This is my son, listen to him." Essentialism. One arrow. One person where all begins and ends. And I love this text. This is a good reminder for us right now as we're getting ready to enter into the season of Lent. And I'm not sure if you're a person who's ever commemorated the season of Lent. Maybe it's not part of your tradition. If you've never read about it or looked into it or thought about kind of how you might really fully engage in the season, please take a couple days to read about it. It's, you know, it's a Google search away. And consider really engaging it this year. For me, it's the best time of the year for me. I love Lent. And this is a good way to lead into Lent, because Transfiguration leads us into the season of Lent by distilling everything down to its most essential place. The truth is that we all, like the disciples, have got a million things happening at once. We are pulled a million different ways, a myriad of things going on at all times. And even in the best moments, there are so many things that can distract or obscure or obstruct the one thing that matters. My theology, my politics, my craziness of my current experiences, my job, my fill in the blank. All of those things that draw my love and my energy and my attention and my worship. And into this space, the cloud comes, the voice speaks. And he says, it's only about this one thing. And for this Lenten season, we try to enter into that truth of what is most essential. Like the disciples, we allow it all to transform back into that one specific face. This is Jesus, the Son I love. Listen, don't just hear, listen to him. The one essential thing. So I ask the question of myself and of all of us, what if, spiritually speaking, I was just that one arrow kind of person? What if that was the one thing that I really pursued? What if the church at large just had that one thing? How many political, relational, religious messes would we avoid? How many shrines to peripheral things would we never build in the first place? How many veils would simply be removed? How much less distracted by everything that doesn't really matter would we be if we just saw the one face and listened? It's good to be reminded of this as we head into Lent, as we intentionally step out into the desert, as we intentionally walk away from life as normal and pray or fast or whatever it is that we do to shake ourselves out of life as usual. It's good as we head into the desert for 40 days of Lent that we have this reminder that brings all things together. This one face where all of God's glory rests. This Jesus, this beloved Son, and just listening to him. Let's pray.